to 44. Hump had done what King asked in his note and hadn't ventured out of the motel room for the last few days. It was easy enough. Flush with his 7 grand cash, he'd ordered in Chinese food and pizza, but only from places that had Pepsi bottles or cans. He was pretty sure some chick at a Chinese takeout place had cursed at him after he told her to skip the order if they didn't sell Pepsi. She kept telling him, "Only Coke, only Coke," her voice getting louder and louder until she was screaming at him, "Only Coke!" Looking in the mirror now, finger combing his hair after getting out of the shower, he thought that she wouldn't have screamed at him if he was standing right in front of her. No, she would have shut her stupid mouth and offered to go next door to the deli and buy him some Pepsi. Would have paid for it, too. And he had also splurged on some movies. He'd watched some of them 3 times. He liked the one about the guy trapped on Mars. He liked that one a lot. When you've been inside, been in solitary, you understand what that's like. Except that inside, hope runs out before the bad food. He also watched some skin flicks. He didn't like them as much because they only frustrated him. He had a better chance of getting trapped on Mars than getting to be with any of them girls. Then he looked at the wad of cash on the dresser and realized that even a guy with a face like his could get anything with enough money. Hump clicked on the TV, figuring he'd lay low for one more day and then move on. He could go a long way on what was left of his 7 grand. Plus, he still had some of his release money stashed away. He thought about where he might go. He thought about going someplace hot and dry, someplace where it didn't rain a lot. He didn't like rain, hated it. It was always bleak inside. But there were times the rain darkened the place so he thought about killing himself or killing someone else just to make the rain in his head go away. He wanted to get as far from the rain as he could get. Tomorrow, he thought, when he left this dump, he'd get himself some maps of the Southwest, buy himself a bus ticket, and just go. But first, he had to see about selling the dragonfly ring. He pulled out the drawer, grabbed his bundled-up white socks, and carefully pulled them apart. He slid his hand down into one of the socks, the one with the tear above the ankle, and felt for the ring. Inside, you learn about how and where to hide things. You also learn to hide how you feel. It was always safer to never give away your feelings. You never wanted the other guys to know what you were thinking. But Hump couldn't hide the smile when he felt the ring there where he'd left it. He held it up to the light as he did each time he looked at it. It was a beautiful thing to behold. He imagined it on a woman's red-tipped finger, the long tail of the dragonfly curling around her pale skin, the 4 jewel-encrusted wings spreading slightly across her pinky and middle fingers. He had never had much beauty in his life, and had certainly never had beautiful things. Watching it sparkle in the light, he thought he might not fence it. He wanted to have one precious thing to hold on to, even if it was a fancy lady's ring that he couldn't wear or show to anyone. He knew that even the best deal he would get would only make him pennies on the dollar. Maybe less, because besides the big diamonds that were the dragonfly's eyes, he had no idea about what kind of stones were in the setting. Rubies, sapphires, and emeralds, he figured. But even if they were, so what? He didn't know what they were worth, didn't know what the diamonds were worth. The gold setting had some value, though that was the least of it. He placed the ring back into the sock, bundled the socks back together, and placed the bundle back in the drawer. He rubbed the thick stubble that he'd let grow on his face since the day the old lady died. By tomorrow, he thought, it would almost be a beard. Between a beard, sunglasses, and a hat, he'd be okay. He sprayed some Right Guard under his arms, threw on some clothes, and reached for the clicker. He plopped himself down on the bed, thinking King would know what the ring was worth. King was smart like that. But King would lose his mind if he found out Hump had taken the ring. Even though no one was there to see it, Hump shrugged his shoulders. Maybe they'd hook up again someday. They were good together, on the inside and out. He slid his index finger over the clicker buttons, searching for the ones that would get him to the paid movie channels. But when he looked up at the screen, he stopped moving his finger. Stopped moving at all. Stopped breathing for a second. Because there, on the screen, was Hump's booking photo next to King's booking photo. Then King's photo was enlarged, completely displacing Hump's photo. Then King's photo disappeared and was replaced by the image of a tall, good-looking cop standing before a row of microphones. Hump turned up the sound so he could hear what the cop was saying. When he heard, he turned off the TV. He and King hadn't been partners, not like some guys they'd known inside who worked together for years. They weren't part of a crew. They were just two guys who had shared a cell for a few years and got along, each watching the other's back. King was older and smarter, but he was as big a screw-up as Hump, maybe even a bigger one. Still, King had been his friend, and now his friend had been murdered. Hump knew he should walk out of that room and never look back. He should fence the ring and just get on that bus to the place where it didn't rain. Instead, he clicked off the TV and searched the drawers King had used for his stuff while he'd been there. Chapter 45. Jesse waited for Henry Wilmot in the lobby outside the curator's office. The Kane Library was at the center of what used to be all of Paradise, what the townspeople now called Old Town. It was where most of the quaint shops were, the ones that catered to the folks who came in spring for the garden tours and tours of the Victorian houses, the ones who came in summer for the regatta, and the ones who came in the fall for the changing of the leaves. These shops that had once been home to the butcher, baker, dry goods store, greengrocer, and cobbler were now leased by cafes, antique stores, art galleries, and tourist shops that sold souvenirs, sunblock, old-timey whaling paraphernalia, and plastic scrimshaw. Old Town wasn't far from Pilgrim Cove and the old Kane House. Jesse got tired of sitting. Between his visit to Dick's and the press conference, he was full of the kind of energy he got charged with when he did unsettling or unpleasant things. Though his visit with Dick's went as he had expected, and the press conference had gone off without a hitch, he was wound up. He thought it might be a rebound effect from the day before, and that in a few more hours he would begin to feel the drag on his body from the drinking, the nausea, the coffee, and the lack of sleep. It was an edgy, brittle kind of energy he was feeling as he strolled through the museum displays. Although it was called the Kane Library, the building also housed the Kane Museum. The museum told the story of the founders of Paradise and housed collections of art, finery, clothing, jewelry, silverware, family histories, and things like small stained glass windows removed from their grand houses on the bluffs before demolition. Jesse, forgive me, said Henry Wilmot, scurrying toward him, his right hand extended. I'm so sorry, but I was on the phone with the broker for one of the Salters. They want to make a contribution. Wilmot was shorter than Jesse, but not by much, though his hunched posture made him appear smaller than he actually was. His wispy gray hair, wire-rimmed glasses, and papery white skin gave him the look of a Dickens clerk. Jesse wasn't fooled. Henry Wilmot had a handshake like a vice. No problem, Henry. I saw the press conference on the local news at noon. This is a bad business. I mean, between poor Maud and this fellow, awful stuff, just awful. Uh-huh. So, Jesse, how can a lowly curator and librarian assist the chief of our local constabulary? Molly tells me you're the man to talk to about the Canes. I believe I am. Yes, indeed I am. What about the Canes? Then he talked over himself before Jesse could answer. Poor Maud. I'm afraid she was the last in the line of a wonderful and generous family. Did you know her?
I did not.
A shame. She was a lovely woman, really.
So, Henry, I was wondering if you knew whether Maud kept any valuables in her house. Something either she or her family hadn't donated to a good cause or to the museum.
Henry thought about it for a few seconds. Then a light seemed to go on in his gray eyes behind his glasses.
He made a hook of his index finger and waved it at Jesse. Come with me. Jesse followed him back past the waiting area, past Wilmot's office, down two half flights of stairs, and into an area that, unlike the wood-paneled walls and creaky planked floor of the museum and library, was all concrete and steel. Wilmot reached into his pocket for a key and opened the large steel door before them. Inside, a ceiling light popped on. Wilmot tapped a code on a keypad affixed to the wall just below the light and motion sensor. Precaution, you know, he said, turning to Jesse. We store our most valuable small pieces in here that are not currently on display. We store our artwork at a different facility. Please, have a seat. Running down the center of the windowless room was a long black marble-topped island. Six high stools on poles bolted to the floor were on either side of the island. At the center of the island were six magnifying lamps, mounted on spring-loaded articulated arms. The walls of the room were actually drawers of varying sizes. Each drawer had a keypad on its face. Wilmot walked over to a large drawer opposite Jesse and punched in a code. A buzzer sounded, a lock unlatched, and Wilmot pulled out the drawer. He reached in and pulled out a foot-square, blue velvet-lined tray and placed it before Jesse. Featured on the tray were a pair of earrings, a necklace, a brooch, a bracelet, a decorative hair comb, and three bangles. All of the pieces were of a dragonfly motif, but the brooch was especially beautiful. All of the jewelry was crafted in gold and featured diamonds, rubies, and emeralds. Breathtaking, aren't they? René Lalique himself designed these pieces for Zachariah Kane Jr., who presented them to his wife Emma as a birthday gift. Emma left them to Maud, who donated them to the museum in 1973. Jesse had no idea who René Lalique was, but the beauty and craftsmanship of the pieces were undeniable. He noticed something else, an empty spot on the tray. He pointed that spot out to Henry Wilmot. Yes, the ring. It was the one piece in the set Maud could not part with. We are to receive it upon the execution of her will. Then Wilmot made a face, not a happy one. Oh no, Jesse, are you telling me you haven't found the ring among her possessions? What a tragedy. You see, the endowment the Canes left to us has been drained away over the years as a result of foolish spending and poor investments. The auctioning off of this set was to infuse the endowment with new cash. With the ring, the complete set would be worth millions. But even without the ring? Yes, it is still a valuable collection, no doubt. But the ring and the brooch are the stars of the set. It would be like Casablanca with Bogey and no Bergman. No, no, the ring is of premium importance to the set and the future of the museum. We must get it back. We simply must. Have you got an image of it? I do. Come up to my office. Following behind Wilmot, Jesse asked, Do you know why Maud was selling her house? She was too old to manage any longer, and it was falling into terrible disrepair. She knew it was time for her to take whatever funds she could get out of the place and find an assisted living facility. Did she have any takers? Jesse supposed he was thinking as much about his inability to sell his place as he was about the late Maud Kane's prospects. You'd have to ask her agent. The fate of the house wasn't part of our concern. Back on the street, Jesse stared at the image of the ring. He hadn't had the heart to tell Wilmot that the chances of recovering the ring intact weren't very good, though that wasn't what was troubling him at the moment. None of what Jesse had learned from Henry Wilmot, nor the questions that information raised, had done a thing to dissipate the buzz of negative energy he'd felt while waiting outside the curator's office. If anything, it made it worse. Chapter 46. Back at the office, Jesse was working off some of his energy by pounding a hard ball into the pocket of his old glove. Then, as suddenly as he had started, he stopped and called Alicia into his office. What is it, Jesse? She asked, closing the door behind her. I'm sorry about yesterday. You shouldn't have been put in that situation. You don't have to apologize to me, Jesse. Where would I be if you didn't hire me? I know I wasn't who they wanted you to hire. I was happy to help. Proud that Molly trusted me enough to ask. I'm grateful, but that's not the point, Alicia. It's not your job to babysit me. It's not Molly's either. I'm sorry. Apology accepted. There was a knock at the office door, and it opened before Jesse could answer. This a private party, or can anyone join? Molly asked, stepping in and closing the door behind her. Alicia said, Is that all, Jesse? Sure. Molly was curious, but waited until Alicia had gone back to the desk. What was that about? Yesterday. Oh. Oh is right. If you're going to bite my head off for... Relax, Jesse said, interrupting her. I was apologizing to her. Why? I was the one who got her in the middle of the situation. But there shouldn't have been a situation. I was responsible for that. Molly wasn't going to argue with him, so that's where they left it. Jesse asked, Are you in for the day? For as long as you need me or until the overtime budget runs out. I've cooked enough food for my family for the next 2 days, and everyone knows where they can find me. Jesse waved Molly over to his desk and handed her the photo of the missing dragonfly ring. My goodness, it's gorgeous! Molly held out her left hand next to the photo, as if imagining the ring on her finger. It's also missing from Maud Kane's house. Jesse told Molly about his visit with Henry Wilmot. As he explained it to her, he could see Molly's wheels turning. She asked, You think Kernet and Bolton ripped Maud's house apart to find this ring? It would explain why one might kill the other if they found it. In L.A., I handled more than one case where friends killed each other over pocket change, so something worth as much as that ring would be reason enough. Molly saw the look on Jesse's face. But this isn't L.A., and that ring isn't pocket change. I can tell you don't like it. You do know me. Too well, Molly said with a laugh. So, what's bothering you about it? Everything. That narrows it down. Okay, how do two low-rent guys like Kernet and Bolton know about this ring? You read their sheets. Either one of them strike you as a master jewel thief? You know what it's like inside. All those guys do is talk about big scores. But only a very few people even knew she had the ring, or about her deal with the museum. Maybe someone hired Bolton and Kernet. Jesse smiled. I like that better. But unless you suspect Henry Wilmot, Maud's lawyer, or Maud herself, who hired them? And it doesn't explain why Bolton would make Kernet come back to Paradise to kill him. Maybe they never left town, and maybe Bolton just picked the wrong place to get rid of his partner. And maybe he just happened to decide to call it into the police to make sure the body was found. I'm also pretty sure the person who called it into the station was the killer. Why would Bolton do that? Okay, so then what? I don't know. I read the ballistics report, Jesse said. The bullets that killed Kernet were .22s, most likely fired from a Walther. Yeah, Jesse, I read it too. The slug recovered from the head was badly distorted, but the one recovered from the chest was in pretty good shape. We recovered a 9mm at the scene with Kernet's prints all over the gun and ammo. Either Bolton or Kernet strike you as types to carry .22s, or to bother with homemade sound suppressors? Now Molly was wearing the same skeptical face as her chief. Okay, Jesse, so, if the ring is missing, but no one hired these guys to find it, and the job wasn't their idea, it means they were looking for something else. But what? You tell me.